morning. Our case this morning will be United States against Green. Counsel for the defense.
With the court's indulgence, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's granted.
Please the court. My name is Major Bill Ruling, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Steve Hendricks, represent Sergeant Danielle Green in today's case. Trial advocacy practitioners have long held that the most effective way to communicate something to someone is through the concepts of primacy and recency. This is precisely the approach Judge Swan used in Appellant's case. When he admonished Appellant for his conduct prior to announcing sentence, he began his explanation with how Sergeant Green had missed reading one of the Ten Commandments, and concluded by citing to that often referred to Southern philosopher Charlie Daniels, and deriding him for not following the law of the Bible. I would ask this court to consider three particular points when evaluating this case. First, that while judges enjoy broad discretion regarding sentencing, they may not rely upon impermissible factors. Secondly, that religion is established as a clearly impermissible factor. Third, that the bench is not a pulpit to espouse religious fervor. Turning to the first point, it's clear that judges enjoy immense discretion when it comes to sentencing. However, they have never been allowed to rely upon impermissible factors. While the Supreme Court and this court have never considered the fact of whether citation to a religious text or commentary during sentencing constitutes a due process violation, the sentencing process itself is constrained by due process. As the United States Supreme Court recognized in Gardner v. Florida, the sentencing process as well as the trial itself must satisfy the requirements of due process. And within the sentencing context, the Fourth Circuit correctly pointed out that sentencing discretion must always be exercised within those boundaries. It's clear through Supreme Court precedent that it is a violation of due process any time an impermissible sentencing factor is relied upon. This was established in the cases of Towson v. Burke and U.S. v. Tucker, and expanded upon in Zant v. Stevens, which pointed out specifically that religion was never a permissible factor. The Due Process Clause requires that a sentence be based on objective legal standards that are established by statutory or case law standards, as opposed to personal or religious standards, as the Ohio Court recognized in the case of Arnett v. Jackson. They recognized that a sentencing judge's religious comments may violate an offender's due process rights when they reveal an explicit intrusion of personal religious principles as the basis of a sentencing decision. That's precisely what happened in this case when Judge Swan started during the pre-sentencing phase, pointing out to the accused that if he was a bad Christian, that's what the church was for. And he carried it through in his soliloquy that he gave to the accused in explaining why he was giving particular weight to things and why he was receiving the sentence that he received. In explaining that, Judge Swan clearly articulated the five sentencing factors and then pointed out that he could give whatever weight he chose to that or any other sentencing matter that he chose.
Counsel, if religion is an impermissible factor, is it the responsibility of the judge then to strike any comments that a convicted service member makes about religion when the service member is giving his or her sentencing testimony or presenting sentencing witnesses?
Sir, I believe this court's precedent is fairly clear that the accused has almost unfettered discretion to say what they choose to say in their unsworn statement. However, we assume from the outset that a judge knows and will apply the law and that he would not give any weight to any religious commentary.
So that a judge is supposed to disregard, affirmatively disregard, an individual's religion when the individual brings his or her faith and religious belief into the sentencing process?
Your Honor, I believe it's a fair statement to say that he must disregard any religious implication to it. Certainly the judge could look to comments that he makes in terms of judging his veracity, but to say that he could give any religious weight to it is where it crosses the line.
Not religious weight, but weight in terms of assessing an individual's character. If an individual says, sentence me in light of my character, and my character is reflected in my commitment to my religion in certain ways, is there a case that stands for the proposition that the judge must affirmatively disregard that?
Well, there isn't anything that is I've found in reported cases, the closest thing that would address an accused bringing in their religion into a sentencing or leniency request was a case that the government cited to U.S. versus Romans in the Fifth Circuit. In that case, they relied to some degree upon the fact that the accused had brought his own religious convictions into his leniency request, and that they said that the judge was merely commenting that he had been inconsistent in his behavior. However, that case doesn't really hold a whole lot of even persuasive value, because nowhere in the reported decision or in the decision does it even say what the judge specifically said to him or how he had brought it in. So it's
if you had an opportunity to look at the record of that case and determine why it shouldn't be given a persuasive authority? That is, what's your view of what the judge said in Lemons?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. Based on reading the case itself, I was not able to glean specifically what the judge had said.
And you weren't able to obtain that information?
No, I was not, Your Honor.
Is it unavailable?
To be honest, I did not seek directly with the Fifth Circuit access to that.
Okay, thank you.
To that court record. Judge Swan's particular comments.
Can you clarify what test you hope we apply? You've said that religion is an impermissible factor, and then you have cited to Arnett saying that it may be a due process issue. What are you looking for here? Some sort of a per se rule, no mention of the word religion? Are you arguing that it... Give me a sense of what your nuance is, if any.
Your Honor, I think that, again, turning to a case that the government cited in their brief, State versus Patino out of the Nebraska Supreme Court, had a pretty good articulation of how that could come out. They said because the trial judge interjected his own religious views immediately prior to sentencing, a reasonable person could conclude that the sentence was based upon the personal bias or prejudice of the judge. If a judge's comments during sentencing could cause a reasonable person to question the impartiality of the judge, then the defendant has been deprived of due process, and the judge has abused his or her discretion. I think that sets a pretty good standard up in saying that...
So it's the interjection of the judge's own religious views and the potential for them to inform the sentence, not citation to religion itself or reference to religion.
Your Honor, I don't think that a pure reference to religion is going to per se create a problem. There's two levels that the Patino court seems to be referring to. First of all, there's an objective standard of did he clearly put his own personal views in? But secondly, there's a subjective standard there of could a perception be created within the public viewing this that there was a religious component to the sentencing? And that falls back to the Supreme Court standard that says any reliance giving any weight to an impermissible factor is sufficient to be a violation of due process. So in other words, it doesn't have to be to the extreme that some of the courts, such as the Arnett court found, where they looked to whether or not it was the final determination. If it's given any weight in the sentencing factors, then it should be considered a violation and impermissible. And that's precisely what Judge Swan appears to have done. As the court looks through the admonition that Judge Swan gave in explaining why the sentence was what it was, he specifically, the tone of what he had said even changed to where he started referring to things in the first person, where he said, some of the documents I've seen describe you as God-fearing, strong in your belief in God. The last time I looked, there were 10 commandments. Apparently one of those which addresses your actions you must have missed in the reading. This goes hand in hand with his statement he had made during the pre-sentencing proceedings, where he had said, even good Christians can make mistakes, and that's what the church is for, indicating his own fervor towards belief that there should be some retribution for the moral and religious violations that he had his transgressions. In particular, then, he concluded very tellingly by saying that every choice in life has repercussion. It reminds me of an old Charlie Daniels saying from a country music song. You know what the problem in the world today is? People done gone and put their Bibles away. They're living by the law of the jungle, not the law of the land. Accused and counsel, please rise. He was equating the Bible and its teachings with the law of the land, something that's clearly impermissible under our constitutional scheme. But more importantly, it implicates exactly what the Patino court was saying in terms of the perception factor. When it is so intricately intertwined with the way that the sentence was formulated and communicated to the accused and to the public, it gives the perception that that factor was given weight, and that is improper. As the Fourth Circuit pointed out...
How do you know whether that he's being folksy or whether he's being religious there?
Your Honor, I think the totality of the case really communicates that it wasn't just being folksy. The fact that he started as far as the pre-sentencing, and keep in mind that the comment about the church being the one to respond to bad Christians comes in response to an exhibit that had not even been offered to the court yet, that the judge had been perusing just to see what was coming in the future. And he latched on immediately to the fact that an assistant manager from KFC was going to make a comment that he was a good Christian.
Well, he'd already given his statement as well, hadn't he?
He had not at the point that
he had not?
Place, Your Honor.
Okay. What if the judge recited the law of the jungle? Do you know the law of the jungle? The strength of the wolf is the pack, and the strength of the pack is the wolf. And would we be here today saying that's an impermissible factor? He's obviously sentencing him on the basis of the law of the jungle and not on permissible factors. Is it the religion here that generates the due process issue for you, or is it just any impermissible factor?
Well, certainly impermissible factors in general are problematic, as the Supreme Court has stated. However, the facts of this case place it squarely within the context of the religious commentary, and that's what we bring to the court today. And so
is religion a particularly perilous due process zone? Or are you just out there trolling for things that are impermissible and you're looking for the purity of the sentencing process?
Your Honor, I think certainly the purity of, as I said, the purity of the sentencing process is important. That has been clearly established through precedent. In fact, in Gardner v. Florida, the Supreme Court pointed out that defendants have a legitimate interest in the character of the procedure which leads to the imposition of the sentence, even if he has no right to object to a particular result. However, given the way that the issue is framed and the way that it comes before this court, today we are most concerned with the religious aspect of it. It's an issue of first impression and one that gives this court an opportunity to certainly set forward a stance as far as impermissible sentencing factors, but with this one sentencing factor in particular. And Robinson v. Polk in the Fourth Circuit pointed out why that was important when they talked about the constitutional line is crossed where the Bible ceases to be used for personal sustenance and reflection and is instead relied upon to decide a defendant's fate. What comes through throughout the course of this is that Judge Swan takes this almost a side comment that was going to come up in an eventual defense exhibit if it was admitted, that the accused was viewed by an assistant manager at KFC to be a religious person, and then he said that he has always felt that he tried to live up to the glory of God and that he fell short. But it's important to note that nowhere in the record, to include in the accused enlisted record brief, does it even state a religious preference. And so Judge Swan is assuming that this relates to his own Judeo-Christian values as opposed to any particular values that Sergeant Green may have had.
Aren't you assuming that the judge is assuming that? How do we know that?
Your Honor, certainly he is drawing upon Judeo-Christian philosophy when he points out the Ten Commandments, when he refers to the Golden Rule.
But your client, in his unsworn statement, certainly invoked God and his belief in God, and he submitted a prayer that he signed that asked for God's protection and asked for forgiveness. Doesn't that inject into proceedings his religious beliefs?
Your Honor, certainly he has mentioned religion and he has brought it into the court.
And what's wrong then with the judge commenting on the defendant's religious beliefs? Does that always mean that he's injecting his beliefs?
Your Honor, to the extent that he puts it in the context of this is why I'm giving you the sentence that I'm giving you, yes, it seems to inject his own personal religious views, especially when it takes that tact of being put into the first person and referring to it in terms of his opinion about what the church is for and his opinion as to what the Ten Commandments mean and his opinion that that's the problem that society is facing is that people put their Bibles away. At that point, it ceases to be a commentary on what the accused believes, which I don't think would be an appropriate response to take anyhow, and it becomes a commentary on what Judge Swan personally believes and his own sense of outrage page at the moral decisions that were made by Sergeant Green.
Now, where do you get the judge's sense of outrage from this record? I've read the record, and I don't detect any sense of outrage emanating from it.
Your Honor, again, page 323, where he talks about even good Christians can make mistakes. That's what the church is for. I'm not going to consider that aspect of it, whether he's a good Christian or he's not a good Christian. And then when he goes on to say...
Okay, well, how about that last statement? I'm not going to consider that aspect.
Your Honor, had he stopped there, we would be in a much different position, and we wouldn't be coming forward to this court with this issue. Because, as I started out saying with respect to the discretion that a judge entails, or enjoys, we start with the assumption that a judge knows and will follow the law. And so had he said, okay, I understand you've objected to this, and I recognize that whether he's a good Christian or not is not a permissible factor, I'm not going to rely upon it, and moved on and not brought this other commentary into it, we wouldn't have brought the issue. Unfortunately, he didn't let it lie. He brought it back up himself when he said, this is why you're getting the sentence you're getting. Because you forgot one of the Ten Commandments.
Well, he gave him a number. He gave him a number of reasons as to why he was getting the sentence that he received.
Correct. He did list other reasons in there. And that's why it's important to look to the Supreme Court standard that says giving any weight to an impermissible factor is going to be a due process violation. Not that it has to be the sole considering factor or even the primary factor, just the fact that it's there. In fact, in United States versus Tucker, Stevens, they talked specifically about the fact that if it was given any weight, it prevented you from being able to determine what weight was given or what a proper sentencing outcome would have been absent any reliance upon an impermissible factor. And so in that case, they said that the only proper remedy was to send back the sentence rehearing because there had been some reliance on an impermissible factor. It doesn't require the finding that the Ohio court found that it had to be the final determination.
Counsel, we finished, Judge Irvin?
Yeah.
Were you suggesting in response to Judge Baker's question about whether this is simply an impermissible factor or whether it's a factor focused on religion, were you suggesting that there's an Establishment Clause concern here that distinguishes religion from other impermissible factors? That is, if the judge, in fact, based his decision on religious factors, that would be the state establishing a religion for purposes of a governmental action?
Your Honor, the Fourth Circuit did address that concern to a degree in Robinson v. Polk. There, I believe it was the dissent that wrote in particular saying that if we allowed judges to turn to religious text to explain sentencing factors or to explain sentencing decisions, that it could entail a slippery slope wherein judges would then resort to other religious texts, and at some point we lose control over how that is done.
What about this case? Let's focus specifically on this case. Is there or is there not an Establishment Clause violation in this case?
Your Honor, to the extent that Judge Swann specifically seems to be endorsing Judeo-Christian values in particular with respect to determining an appropriate response for the state to take to transgressions by an individual, there is certainly the potential that it crosses that line of the Establishment Clause. He did not try to entrench a particular, must be Catholic or anything of that nature, but he certainly seemed to indicate that he has gone beyond the presidentially described and adopted standards in RCM 1001 and has gone to a more faith-based determination. And that's the type of problem that the Fourth Circuit pointed out in Robinson, where they said a defendant must never suspect that he was sentenced on the basis of religious dictate, especially if the jury's religious beliefs are not his own. Juries have legitimacy in a democracy because, despite the variety of jurors' beliefs, they are united in the common endeavor of legal judgment. Any contrary perception threatens the most basic premise of the rule of law. And that kind of comes back to the Charlie Daniels quote that he used, where he talked about the problem is people then gone and put their Bibles away. They're living by the law of the jungle and not the law of the land. Allegorically equating the law of the land with the law of the Bible. And that's what we have to avoid, is telling the public or a particular accused, that the law doesn't matter here, that the rule of a democracy is irrelevant, and that instead the rule of faith is going to control.
Counsel, you've given a long answer, and I appreciate that. Please tell me if this characterization of your answer is accurate. That is, your statement, I believe, is no, there was not an Establishment Clause violation, but there's a perception problem. Is that what your answer is?
That is the answer.
Okay, thank you. Now, if we have a free exercise issue here. Before, you suggested that it might be impermissible, that would be impermissible for the accused to bring in religion as a sentencing factor. If an individual were to bring in, let's say, his or her involvement in a civic organization and his or her adherence to the tenets of that organization as a factor, I'm very community oriented, here are all the things I believe in, and my civic association believes in these very high ethical principles. Can a judge in that situation say, well, I know something about that civic organization, and here's what their standards are, and you fell below those? Would that be permissible?
Your Honor, I think it would, to the extent that that seems to fit in with RCM 1001, with rehabilitative potential to society as a whole. What the accused seems to be saying in bringing that forward is, I've got a support network here, and I've got some values that are going to guide me as I move back into society, and here's a plan of how I intend to do that.
And can the accused do that then with a religion? Say, I'm a religious person. I have a support network. I have faith in God. This is what sustains me. Is it permissible for the accused to bring that in as a sentencing consideration?
I believe it's permissible for him to say that, and that what the court must distinguish then in giving weight to any of that testimony is they have to factor out the religious aspect of it and view it in terms, again, of a societal involvement, not in terms of a involvement with a particular religious sect or belief.
So the judge is then supposed to disregard anything that the judge might know about that religion in assessing the validity of the accused's request?
I think that that's an appropriate standard to take for a judge, in the same vein that we ask a judge, for example, to make determinations about admissibility of evidence, where they're allowed to consider inadmissible factors once they've decided that evidence is then admissible, or if they've sustained an objection and excluded something, we allow them to stand in judgment, setting aside in their own mind all impermissible considerations.
So the judge wouldn't have to disregard what he knows about the civic organization, but does have to disregard what he knows about the religious organization?
To the extent that we're talking about value judgments and religious tenets, yes, I think that's an accurate statement, Your Honor.
Okay, I think I understand your answer. Thank you.
Gentlemen, at the core of what this case brings before you is an issue of whether or not a judge is bound by the constraints of discretion within the confines of due process. I urge this court to keep in mind that while the judge may enjoy broad discretion, he cannot violate due process, that reliance upon religion or any other impermissible factor violates due process, and that this court has an opportunity to make a statement that has not yet been made to military judges.
Should we test what occurred? If you're correct that there was a due process error, is there any prejudice analysis involved?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court's holding in Zamp v. Stevens seems to indicate that the per se due process violation is going to necessitate sending it back. If this court finds that Judge Swan gave any weight whatsoever to religion, then that is a per se violation which requires setting aside the sentencing phase of the trial, I believe, is the stance that the Supreme Court took. And so, but I think this court could look to prejudice both in terms of the perceptional violation that occurs, that not only is Sergeant Green's rights curtailed, but also those of the public and the support that the military justice system has, but also this court can't really accurately tell what the proper sentence was going to be absent reliance upon this factor. So it's impossible to have any confidence in what the sentencing determination was. And that would be sufficient to complete any prejudice analysis this court would need.
And that would be your view regardless of what the sentence was?
Correct, Your Honor. Ultimately, I would ask this court to tell military judges that the bench is not a pulpit and that they should stick to the factors that are outlined in the military judge's bench book and that have been supported through this court's precedent.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. My name is Captain Adam Kazin. Myself and Colonel John Miller represent the United States. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in sentencing appellant. Appellant was properly sentenced for the despicable crimes and the harm he caused his victims, his unit, and the United States Army, and not based on any personal religious belief held by the military judge. His sentence should be affirmed. Appellant's argument fails on 3 points. First, appellant misconstrues the case of United States versus Baker and fails to properly address the concept of a due process violation. Second, appellant relies heavily on the district court case in Arnett versus Jackson, even though the Sixth Circuit overturned the district court opinion and repudiated the magistrate's analysis of the judge's comments in that case. And third, the facts of this particular case do not support appellant's contention that the military judge sentenced him based on personal religious grounds. A couple of points to make based on the arguments we just heard. First, the military judge never declared appellant a Christian. Nowhere in the record does it say that. The military judge was addressing what appellant had said in his unsworn statement. The military judge's comments and anything that may be construed as religious must be placed in the proper context of the sentencing of both what the appellant had said during his unsworn statement and the comments the judge said to appellant during the sentencing. The first thing the military judge said was nothing to do with the Ten Commandments. The first thing the military judge said was, there are soldiers in this courtroom, and I believe that you and they have the opportunity and the right to know the basis of the sentence. This is part of the judge's discretion in the sentencing. The standard that the judge is the community spokesperson is well established, although not specifically in the military justice system. Both the Fourth, the Fifth, and the Sixth Circuits all basically agree with the Baker analysis that the judge is the community spokesperson, and that a lecture of the accused may be appropriate in certain cases, and the judge has that discretion. So the judge laid that out.
So are you making the argument that this judge is representing the military community in his comments, and it's the military community's view that Charlie Daniels speaks for the military and all that? Is that really your argument?
Not that specifically, Your Honors. The military judge is the community spokesperson, and expressing dissatisfaction with the appellant's behavior is part of the military judge's prerogative. The use of Charlie Daniels is simply, for lack of a better term, poetry. It's not Shakespeare, it's not Sartre or Nietzsche or Oliver Wendell Holmes, but it's simply at that point, in the context of what the judge was saying, the musing of the judge.
Is it the government's position that all the references that the appellant is complaining about here are merely reflections of the community?
Not necessarily, but they are the reflections of the judge addressing things the appellant had brought up in his unsworn statement and in his submissions to the court. The idea that the appellant has failed to live up to his own values and the idea that the appellant's conduct is reprehensible is what would be the judge's speaking on behalf of the community.
But we're not here debating today whether his conduct was reprehensible or not. We're debating, are we not, whether the judge relied on impermissible factor of religion.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so stay focused on that, if you would.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is he or is he not speaking for the military community when he cites two religious factors in his statement?
He is speaking on behalf of the military community, Your Honor. However, the references to religion the judge speaking that the community has set up a religious standard. The judge, again, the context is going to be everything in this case. Had the appellant not mentioned anything about religion during his unsworn statement, comments about religion would be considered much less appropriate. Another example would be if the appellant had gotten up and said, I tried to live my life by the Army values.
So this is an opening the door kind of argument. If the appellant brings up something impermissible, then it's fair game for the judge to rely on impermissible factors as well?
Well, it's not an impermissible factor if the appellant is bringing forth his value system in front of the judge. It happens to be religious-based. It would be much different if the judge was trying to sentence him based because he was a member of a specific religion. The obvious due process violation would be if the judge says, I don't like Christians. Christians get 6 more months on their sentence than other people do. That's an obvious due process violation. Another one would be where the judge says, your crimes are not that severe. However, the Bible mandates that adulterers and people who commit crimes of sexual immorality receive a stoning. Since I can't stone you, I have to give you the maximum penalty. That's another one where the judge is ceding his discretion to a religious-based edict.
That's not this case.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's why I was saying, in the context of this case, the judge is not relying on an impermissible factor. He's not relying on religion. He's simply addressing the appellant's claims of religious fidelity and his value system. In the same way that if the appellant had said, I try to live my life by the Army values, and the judge had said, no, that's not the Army values. This is how the Army values work.
Well, let's talk about impermissible comments then.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where was it that the accused said, I live my life by these values? As I read what the accused said, I didn't live my life by these values.
Well,
so if he says he didn't live his life by these values, what purpose is there in the judge hammering him further by bringing in concepts of that particular religion when he's not relying on that religion in his statement as an excuse or an explanation for what he did?
But the appellant's statements, and I refer to a couple of them, instead of giving my matters to God and seeking comfort with my wife, I want the people I was close to. God has always been the center of my life, but in my moment of distress, I fell short of his glory.
Isn't he saying there, I didn't adhere to my religion?
And the judge is essentially agreeing with him on that point.
Oh, so all we have is an amen statement by the judge.
To a certain degree. And the judge is sitting there, and he's seeing the demeanor of the appellant, and the judge made that judgment call, that using that discretion, that something needed to be said, a lesson needed to be made of this. And that's part of the judge's job. If he's got soldiers in the courtroom, you know, one of the sentencing factors is deterrence. And perhaps trying to teach and make something good out of what is a pretty bad situation is within the judge's discretion. And to a certain degree, it's an amen statement. To another degree, it's the judge. Later on, the appellant talks about these were mistakes, and the judge specifically addresses that, saying these were not mistakes, these were choices. That's right prior to the Charlie Daniels reference. That reference is simply saying that you chose not to go by your value system. You chose to abandon it, and that has repercussions. It wasn't saying that the repercussion, that the appellant somehow violated the judge's own sense of religious propriety. In fact, we had absolutely no idea what the judge's religion is, or that the judge even has religion. Like I said, the judge never declared the appellant Christian. The judge never revealed what his religion was. His comments are the references to religion, the three mentioned by appellant, the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule, which is a fairly universal concept, and the Charlie Daniels reference, in the context of everything the judge said, are fairly innocuous compared to the overall statements the judge was making. There's about 12 points the judge made in his sentencing argument. Beyond the sentencing factors, he talked about the appellant's failure as an NCO and his failure to take it to fix the relaxed atmosphere in the unit. He talked about the appellant's responsibility in causing several soldiers to say they didn't want to be in the Army anymore. I talked about the harm the appellant caused his family, but then the judge went on to say that I'm going to consider your family and their stake in this because they're innocent in this. He talks about the mothers and fathers sending their children to the Army, not having to worry about superiors hitting on them. He talks about abusing his position.
Appellant's not making the argument that the judge didn't cite to permissible factors. He's making the argument he also included an impermissible factor. So are you arguing if there's 17 permissible factors and one impermissible, that's fine?
No, Your Honor. What the government's position is that the context is going to equate whether or not it was an impermissible factor or not. If the judge had started going off about religion with no religious references from the appellant, it would have been much more suspect.
Can I ask you, where do you agree or disagree with the appellant's statement of what he believes the law is or ought to be? The appellant presented a two-pronged test, an objective element that involved interjection of a judge's own religious beliefs and a subjective perception type element. Can you please comment on that, and then comment as well on the appellant's assertion that one does not test for prejudice because any reference is you can't dissect whether it impacts or not.
The first part of the test, whether or not the judge interjected his personal religious beliefs, I believe that was the subjective portion that the appellant talked about, whether or not...
Correct.
That would appear to be the test that both is enunciated in Arnett versus Jackson and U.S. versus Baker. The perception point of it...
Well, no, I'm asking, do you agree with that or not? I mean, do you believe that's the correct test?
Whether or not the judge... There should be the factual determination of whether or not the judge actually used his personal religious beliefs to sentence appellant is consistent with the government's position.
Full stop?
At that point, yes, Your Honor.
No test for perception, no...
No, Your Honor. Because, again, it's all about context and the context of this case.
And then what's your response to the appellant's statement that in light of Zant, one cannot test for prejudice, harmless beyond a reasonable doubt or whatever?
Well, the government is both in its brief and here relies on this because this has never happened before. United States versus Sales allows, and Article 66 gives appellate courts much broader discretion in reassessing sentences that exist in the federal system. In this case, looking at U.S. versus Sales, the statement that if there is an error, and even if it is of constitutional magnitude, the appellate court, under its Article 66 power, could do a reassessment and then decide whether or not that reassessment cures any constitutional defect. And since we're talking about a due process violation, if there were a due process violation, it would be appropriate to first send it down to the Army Court to do a reassessment and then decide, and then, of course, rule on whether or not that reassessment cures any constitutional defect. Only after that is done would it be necessary to then send it down into a trial court for a new rehearing. That position would be consistent with Sales and consistent with the Army Court's Article 66 power. That, of course, the government is not conceding that it is, in fact, a due process violation. That would simply be the government's...
No, I'm just asking you to respond to their argument.
Roger, Your Honor.
Tit for tat on each item.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'd like to turn to page 20 of your brief where you discuss the Lemons case.
Just a moment, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
And is it possible to tell in Lemons precisely what was said, or we just rely on the circuit court opinion there?
It's not possible. And again, the government as well as the appellant counsel didn't find out what the specific things the judge said. It's a very small section of Lemons. However, what it essentially tells is that the judge made some sort of comment about appellant's church going. It says briefly that the accused in that case offered his convictions and church affiliation in his request for leniency. So that's all we know. And that the district court simply responded that Lemon's conduct was in contrast to his religious convictions. And that's, and the district court did not state its own sense of religious propriety and somehow been betrayed. That's really all we have from Lemon's. And it's only persuasive to that extent. It's not, you know, well, so that's an absolute rule of law. However, it's a good example of another situation where a accused brought forth some sort of religious affiliation as a basis for his value system and a judge commenting on the failure to meet that value system. Does that answer your question, Ryan?
Right. Mm-hmm. And here, where did the accused bring in his value system as either an explanation for his behavior or as a demonstration of any other sentencing factor?
The couple of statements that the government point to is, instead of giving my matters to God and seeking comfort with my wife, I went to the people that I was close to. Again, the appellant essentially saying that I made a choice of either giving my matters to God and being faithful to my wife or doing something else. God has always been the center of my life, but in a moment of distress, I fell short of his glory. So again, appellant saying his conduct fell short of God's glory. There doesn't do a whole lot of reading into what appellant is saying, and we don't want to try to dig into appellant's brain any more than we want to try to dig into the judge's brain. Just taking the words that we have before us and in their context, making the conclusions based on that. He then says, I pray to God that I have the opportunity to take care of my family and make it up to them. Again, the mentioning of religion is in the context of a plea for leniency, and saying that I have a belief in God. During this period of time that I was committing these crimes, I fell short of that belief in God, but I've asked for forgiveness, my belief in God is back, and I'm okay, is a fair summary of what appellant was trying to say. And the judge's comments on that were a fair comment on what the appellant brought forth.
Page 13, footnote 57. You got a cite to Wikipedia.
Yes, Your Honor.
I looked at Wikipedia this morning because it's always good to look at it, its latest, and it says in there that Wikipedia may contain significant misinformation and unencyclopedic conduct or vandalism. Is Wikipedia the only source for the information that you could find that you're citing in footnote 57?
I apologize for that source, Your Honor. It was simply the Wikipedia lists a great deal of sources, both in the Quran and the Old Testament, the New Testament, several other texts, where the concept of the word and will can be found, and using Wikipedia. I have no specific source, Your Honor. However,
if this court wanted to take judicial notice of the Golden Rule, there might be other sources we could rely on.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would suggest that Wikipedia be a starting point, not a finishing point for that
research.
And again, that was really done in primarily because of the reference to calling it Jesus Christ's Golden Rule in the appellant's brief. That's simply not an accurate title for it. And the idea is that treat others as you would be treated is a fairly broad concept. And again, this is while maybe partially religiously derived, is a fair community maxim. And the Arnett Court actually spoke that the judge setting forth, even though religiously derived, a community maxim is perfectly appropriate. And again, it all comes back to the context of what was said to him and what he was trying to relate back to both appellant and to those in the audience. One point to make is the case of Robinson versus Polk and it being placed in its proper context. Robinson versus Polk first was a Sixth Amendment claim. It was not a due process claim or an Establishment Clause issue. It involved one of the jury in a death penalty case bringing a Bible into the jury room and reading an eye for an eye portion, not sure which one, and then trying to convince other jurors that was a proper basis. The case cited by appellant in that language is not the decision of the Fourth Circuit. It is one concurring opinion of one of the judges who ruled against an en banc consideration. So this idea that there is a case out there that stands for the proposition that religion cannot be used at ever in the deliberative process is simply not there. Again, this wasn't a case where the military judge was utilizing the appellant's religion as a basis for a sentence or utilizing his own religion as a basis for a sentence. He was sentencing appellant based on appellant's conduct and commenting to appellant about his failure to meet his particular values. Something else that the appellant counsel had said about basically trying to set a standard for the trial judiciary in the future. What you don't want to create those situations where judges are not the judge should be allowed to speak freely. We do not want to eliminate that status of a trial judge as the community spokesperson. These comments shouldn't be discouraged or encouraged. They should simply be left to the context of the case. And certainly we should remind all judges in the trial judiciary that they should not rely upon permissible factors. They should not sentence an accused based on what their religion is or that they belong to a certain religion any more than they should be sentencing accused based on race or ethnicity. However, judges' commentary on value systems, whether they're based on religion or based on the Army values or based on a community club that they belong to or a civic organization, are fair game for comment if the judge deems it necessary.
Fair game for comment, provided they don't raise the prospect that the judge relied on them?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Fair game for comment, but in commenting on them, is not the judge raising the specter that that's the basis of the sentencing decision? You didn't cap off your statement. You said it's fair to comment on these things.
Yes, Your Honor.
Period. You know, always, anytime.
And certainly, again, if the judge had commented that he was relying on the appellant's religion as a basis for his sentence, that would be a different story. But again, the judge was not relying on appellant's religion. This judge was simply saying that appellant fell short of his own values, and that the excuse.
I'm not trying to get you to revisit your argument. I'm trying to get you to define what you just said, which is it's fair game for a judge to comment on religion.
It's a fair. No, I apologize, Ron. I should have been more clear. It's a fair game for the judge to comment on an appellant's claim of his value system, even if it is based in religion. Just because it's religiously based value system as opposed to an Army value system or an NCO Creed value system doesn't suddenly make it that the judge shouldn't be considering it anymore.
I understand.
As long as I seem to have hit all the points that I want to make, subject to any questions that you may have, I'll go ahead and conclude.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The military judge appropriately lectured appellant about his contemptible behavior, specifically addressing the harms appellant caused to the particular victims and the community in general. Any references to religion were minimal in nature and directly addressed issues appellant raised during his pre-sentencing hearing. Appellant should not be allowed to silence the military judge. The military judge properly exercised his discretion in arriving at an appellant sentence, and that sentence should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal from the defense?
Briefly, Your Honor. The government was exactly right when they said that context is everything. And unfortunately, Judge Swan forgot the lesson that he had learned through the McNutt case, that context truly is everything. This is not the first time that Judge Swan has overstepped his bounds in making extrajudicial comments. He did it in McNutt. He did it here as well. He didn't simply try to address issues that the accused had raised in his unsworn. He went much further. He said expressly, "I think you deserve the benefit, the right to understand why your sentence is what it is. Our system should be open. I believe that includes explaining why I think your sentence is appropriate for you." And then he explained to him that he forgot one of the Ten Commandments and that he put his Bible away too soon. Primacy and recency. He started with the Ten Commandments. He concluded with the Bible. He was sending a very clear contextual message. And that message was, you have violated moral norms which I hold dear, and you must be punished for it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.